Richie Neal, tell me about how goes the battle.
Well, actually, it's going quite well. No complaints. Part of it has been discovery, obviously, in terms of new territory. It's been terrific. Great opportunity to say hello to a host of new people, and I intend to aggressively represent them.
I see that you've been endorsed by a host of labor organizations and other people. How does one get those endorsements? Do you ask for them, or do they offer them? How does it work?
Well, I think part of it's based upon your voting record over a long period of time, and certainly to have the support of all environmental groups and all of organized labor, and to have a healthy mix of business large and small, it's been very integrated, and the truth is that that's been indicative of my career. I've always had a careful balance, understanding that we want to make sure that we have strong employers so that we can have strong employees, and those two are frequently in partnership. So I think that that always has been part of my pronouncements in public life. And I certainly intend not to change it.
Now, you know, your opponents in the primary are throwing all kinds of barbs at you in terms of where you're getting the money to run the campaign, your position on women, abortion, and the rest. I wonder if you could set some of that to rest.
Well, it's fairly easy, I think, that you understand in the course of a campaign where there are very small differences that individuals will levy all sorts of charges in an effort to gain some traction. I think what's interesting, and I would cite this as an example of my career, I have never run a negative television ad through the course of my whole career.
Interesting.
It's fascinating in that sense. I mean, I have never used campaign contributions to disparage an opponent's political views, but I also think it's important to point out that the donations that I have received over a long period of time are reflective of the interests of the people of Massachusetts, and to understand that much of the work that I have done has been broad-based. It's under the magnifying glass of critical analysis. And my sense is that when I hear that my money has come from a small group of people, that completely misses the point in terms of accuracy, that I've also had substantial help from labor over a long, long period of time. And I think that many of the industries who have been supportive of my candidacy and many of the labor groups who have been supportive of my candidacy are also, I think, reflective of the role that the firefighters and the police and the teachers and everybody else has played that have supported me during the course of a long career.
Now, Richie Neal, you know, I hear very good things about you from a lot of my friends, but the one that really impressed me was John Oliver, the now retiring congressman from Amherst, who said that there wasn't, you know, a hair's breadth of difference between the two of you, or something very much along those lines, in terms of your liberal credentials. How did you feel when you heard that?
Well, it was very nice. John's an old friend, and I think he vigorously represented the 1st Congressional District for a long period of time. And I must say that he had a terrific reputation for endlessly drilling down on issues. He took many complicated factors into consideration before he made up his mind. But I also would think that on a number of large issues, including the war in Iraq, there weren't many of us who voted against it. John and I were two of the individuals who did. I got up on the floor and spoke against the Bush tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, and to be very candid with you, spoke against extending them when President Obama made the request and had a chance to question Vice President Biden about that decision. And I think in the instance of John Oliver, I think on many of the major issues, we were certainly in sync. And if there were any differences there, they were really minute.
I'm going to ask you a silly question, and you'll probably tell me it's none of my business, but have you done any polling here?
Yes, we have.
Okay. And how are you doing?
We're doing great. I mean, in fact, one of the things that I think is very telling about a poll, and I say this diplomatically, when you get a poll back, and the pollster that I have used all of these years is David Paleologus, and he has extraordinary credibility, as you know. He has done the Suffolk University Boston Herald poll and, in fact, called the Brown-Coakley race right on the dime. And he has done polling for me for a long period of time. And I think the evidence is evident. I've already agreed to do debates, but you will always find the candidates that are literally far behind demanding debates.
Right.
And the reason for that is largely because they're far behind. And I think that while I've agreed to debates only because I've done them through every campaign that I've ever had, I also think that it hasn't been necessary for me to attack the opposition. I think that's pretty telling, too.
When you are unfairly attacked by the opposition, do you take it personally, or do you take it as sort of microcosm of what a political campaign would be.
I think it's part of the modern vernacular, and I think that's part of the challenge that we all confront. I think that the level of sincerity here is marked by the fact that I was never shopping for a congressional district. I wasn't saying, well, if this is in or that's in, or could you put this in or could you put that in? I instead took the position that the congressional district that's presented to me by the legislature and eventually signed by the governor, I will be very comfortable in. I didn't duck. I made sure over all of these years that I took vigorous positions on many of these tough issues. So I wasn't seeking refuge in another job in an effort to avoid having to take tough votes. I mean, the last thing I think anybody would want is to have somebody who gives up an important position only to take an administrative job and then to announce that because they didn't have to cast any tough votes along the way, that'll better prepare them for having to take tough votes? I don't understand the logic of that consideration.
Do you subscribe to the leadership view of a congressional seat? In other words, you lead and you do what you think is right and either people come along or they don't. Or there are those people who say they're representative. I don't want to be any more than a representative of my district.
No, I think that there are times, it's the old argument, as you know, over whether or not one is a delegate or one is a simple representative. And I think that there are certainly issues where you listen to your constituents, and there are other issues, I think, where you simply have to stand up and take positions that you think in time will mesh with the views that your constituents have when they have an opportunity to review those decisions. Example, the war in Iraq. That was not a popular position to have taken. I mean, over the years, I've taken positions opposing term limits and opposing the line item veto and opposing a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. And I think that when you look back at those positions now, the voters would agree with me, even though at the time they didn't. And at the same time, I was very courteous to people as we were deliberating the run-up to the war in Iraq to hear what they had to say. But for me, the issue was very simple. I went to the briefings and came away convinced that the argument over weapons of mass destruction had simply not been settled.
Richie Neal, talk to me a little bit about one of the more contentious races in Massachusetts, and that's the Brown-Warren race. You mentioned your pollster called it on the nose the last time when Coakley was the opponent of Brown. Do you see a difference in how this is going?
I do, and what I think is it's fair, and I'm going to put on my analyst hat here for a moment.
That's what I want.
It's striking to me, Alan, how few people are up for grabs with essentially 4 months to go.
Interesting. What does that mean?
It means that more than 92% of the people, according to the polling data that we've all had a chance to examine, have made up their minds. And so the opportunity to move that needle is very narrow. And it will occur, I think, in the Boston suburbs. It will occur in perhaps some of Worcester County suburbs and along the South Shore. I think Western Massachusetts is pretty secure for Elizabeth Warren, and I think there are other parts of the state and some of the suburbs, for example, just north of Boston. Those are areas which appear at the time to be a bit fertile for both candidates. And what's ironic about all of this is you can search the voting trends generally by using the last three elections. For example, you can find out how many independent voters have asked for only Democratic ballots during those three election cycles. And then you discern a pattern, and the pattern is in the instance that I've just cited, that individual who might say, I'm an independent, but they've sought three Democratic ballots. So they're really not independent. And you can do the same thing on the Republican side. What you really want in this instance with that 8% or so that says that they're undecided, what you really want to do is to find those individuals who have really crisscrossed. And that's all public information, so that's what many of these companies do on social media sites.
Interesting. So they go in, they look at the registration cards, you know, and they look at the polling data, and they're able to tell who the targets are.
That's exactly right. And if the other example that comes to mind, if you've ever been questioned in a poll frequently as you're asked to the demographic of race, religion, gender, and all of those things, one of the other questions that's always asked is, did you vote in the last election, and then the election before that, then the election before that, because they're going to spend their time with the probable.
Yeah.
They're not going to spend their time on speculation. And then what they want to find out is, what you do in a poll, you want to find out some very serious data. And that way you do that is you've got to keep people on the phone for a long period of time to get a real good snapshot. And that's what the professionals do. A good, accurate poll in a congressional district like the one that I have now probably is going to cost you $20,000 to $25,000.
Yep, it's a lot of money.
It is all of that.
And Richie Neal, always love talking to you, especially because you always teach me something. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Alan.
Come back the next time. I got a whole bunch of questions for you.
Delighted.